That's so vital for our understanding of where we are at and what we're doing. Somebody help me with this, because I spend an awful lot of time thinking about this. He had to be a man to pay for the sacrifice of our sin. You couldn't just, you know, and you think about that. It had to be a man. Why? Why did it have to be a man? Why? Yeah. Christ had demonstrated God had demonstrated pretty conclusively that, first off, blood had to be shed for the forgiveness of sin. So part of the answer, and you guys are like, well, why are you asking that question? Asking why? Well, because that's what God expected. Yeah, I understand that. But think about this for a second. The blood had to be shed in order for our sin to be forgiven. It had to happen. There was no other option. It wasn't like there was like, well, you know, you could do this or you could do that. And in fact, one of the things that I like so much about this process that we've been going through Sunday evening, as we're tracing the arc of the coming of Christ, the promised one, as he moves throughout history, what was the first thing that happened with regard to sacrifice? What was the first sacrifice you see record of? Well, official sacrifice. Cain and Abel, right? Cain and Abel. So what was the significance of that story? What was going on? Why was Cain in such bad spirits? Why was he so angry? God didn't accept his sacrifice. Why not? It wasn't what God asked for. That's not what I'm looking for. Blood had to be shed. And it demonstrates, and you look throughout history and you recognize blood had to be shed. And you think of that, and you consider when we, even now today, and some of us are worse than others, but how many of you faint when you see the sight of blood? Oh, good. Really? That's bad, because you're in the wrong industry if that's true. Whoa. She's an emergency room admittance nurse, so if she faints at the sight of blood, then she probably doesn't spend much time awake at work. The fact is, when you consider, you know, we still, even now, that's the life of the flesh, right, is in the blood, and you see that and you recognize, if I'm bleeding, there's a problem. There's something that needs to be taken care of. And if I'm bleeding a lot, then there's a big problem and there's a big thing that needs taken care of. There's this intimacy, this significance to the reality of the fact that there is blood. And when we realize that blood had to be shed for the remission of sins, for the taking away of my sin. And when I also realize that the blood of animals won't be enough, and my own blood isn't enough either. It had to be perfect blood. How do you get perfect blood? Through a perfect man. It is astounding. It is monumental. That is the singular point in all of history. And we even talked about this, I think it was last Sunday night, when we talked about the arch of history. And we recognize that before the cross and after the cross, everything points to that one point, that one pinnacle of history, where blood, perfect blood, was shed for my sin, so that I can be reconciled in relationship with God, so that I can have fellowship with my Creator. Blood needed to be shed. Astounding. And how was God going to do that? How is it that God was going to shed his perfect blood? He wrapped our injured flesh around him. Wow. Who would have guessed? You think of that and you consider, okay, well, God, you really backed yourself into a corner here. You said perfect blood had to be shed, but you're not like us. You don't have blood, as far as we know. So what are we supposed to do? I mean, how's that going to work? God, you really backed yourself into a corner on this one. And God says, I will send myself, born of a virgin. I will make myself flesh. I will be found in fashion as a man. And in that process, I will humble myself and become obedient to death. Even the death of the cross. Therefore, this is so important. Therefore, he's been given a name that is above every name. What's the therefore? Why is the therefore so significant? It's pointing back to that previous idea. Because he took flesh. Because he embraced our humanity. He is highly exalted and given a name that is above every name. That at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow and every tongue should confess that he is God, to the glory of God the Father. This is so important. This has to blow your mind every time you see it. Not has to, but it should. Because the reality of the incarnate Christ, the reality of my God taking flesh, provides me with hope, provides me with joy, peace, goodwill to men. Why peace and goodwill? Because God is flesh. And there is now opportunity for the sacrifice to be made. An astounding, astounding thing we can consider. I want to take you this morning to another one of our Draw Near series. So turn in your Bibles, please, to the book of Judges. The book of Judges. And I know this isn't technically Christmassy per se, but don't worry, I'll show you how it can be. The book of Judges. So every time we look at these different individuals in the Old Testament and we examine their life and we look into their history and we see what God has done with them and through them, every time we do that, so who have we looked at so far? Remind me. The first guy we looked at was... Oh, I know, it's so long ago. Actually, it's not. It's like 9 weeks ago, which I guess is sort of long, but not for me. I usually go 23 weeks, so that's just like, we're just getting started. Who was the first guy we looked at? Abraham, right. Yep, Abraham, right? Good old Abram from Ur of the Chaldees. Okay, who was the next guy we looked at? Who? Jacob, right. Jacob. Yep, Jacob, or otherwise known as Israel, but stayed Jacob, correct. And then we looked at Moses, correct? And we finished up Moses last week as we examined that interaction with Moses where he went face to face with God. We saw Moses on the mountain experiencing God face to face. But the thing that we identified, and this is one of the things, I don't want to do too much review on this one, but I do want to point this out. As Moses encounters God, what does God show Moses? When Moses says, "Let me see your glory," what does God do? He gives him two things. What's the first thing that God does? When Moses says, "Show me your glory," or "Let me see your magnificence," what does God do? First thing is, do you remember? He tells him his name, right? Remember that weirdness where you're like, "I didn't ask what your name was. I said, what? Show me your glory." And God says, "You want to see my glory? Look at my name. My essence, my character is my glory." And it's kind of funny because a lot of times we talk about bringing glory to God, you know, and I know I've said this a bunch, but I want us to keep this in mind because we use that terminology an awful lot. "God, I want to bring you glory." What does that mean? And again, it doesn't mean, "God, I have something called glory in my hand. This right here, this is glory. God, this is for you. I made this for you. I hope you like it." That's not glory. When we talk about bringing God glory, what are we talking about? Reflecting his glory or his character, right? When I am bringing God glory, I am reflecting his character back to him. That's all it is. It's an expression of reality where I say, "God, this is who you are. You are this. You're righteous. You're just. You're holy. You're good. You're magnificent. You're sovereign. Lord, that's who you are." And as I live my life, I live to reflect that character back to you. Glory. God has all glory. It is bound up within his name, within his very character. That is glory. You want to know what is the most glorious, the most amazing, the most wondrous thing? It's the name and character of God. That's his glory. So God says, "I will tell you my glory. My name is Yahweh. I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and I will be merciful to whom I will be merciful." That is glory. So that's the first thing that God did. But what else did God do? When Moses asked that question, "Show me your glory," what was the second thing that God did? Oh, surely somebody remembers. Hey, are these the flowers I knocked over last week? I'm going to try really hard not to do that this week. What else did God do? Besides telling the name of his, or giving the name of his character, what else did God do? He showed him the backside of his glory, right? The trailing of his glory. But was that glory? Like we say his glory, but what was that? Remember, it was goodness. God says, "I will show you the shadow of goodness." One part of my character, not all of my character, just one part of my character. And I'm going to show you the trailing edge of that. And you are going to be so blown away if I even let you see it full on. The trailing edge of my goodness, you would die. "So I will cover you in the cleft of the rock until I am virtually gone, until just the afterglow of the trailing edge of just my goodness passes before you. And that was enough for 40 days for Moses' face to radiate glory. Wow. Think of how far removed that was from the reality of God's goodness. That was the trailing edge of the backside of his shadow. And yet that was enough to cause Moses' face to literally glow. I was thinking about this last week after I left. Because one of the things that happens at my house is that every now and again I get on this kick in my mind and I can't shut my mind down. And so it'll be like, you know, 1:30 in the morning and I'll be doing some research or some study. And Mindy will be over there. And, you know, she's not here. So pray for my wife because she married me. And the thing is, she's trying to sleep. And I've got the computer on and I've got the light going. And she's like, you know, tossing and turning. And I sometimes I'm so lost in my study I don't recognize that I'm being very inconsiderate. And so finally she'll lean. And you guys know Mindy well enough to know how this is. She'll be like, sweetie, would you mind terribly? I'm really sorry, but would you mind shutting the light off? You know, like she's so gracious about it rather than, shut the light off, what are you doing? Which she would be totally within her right to do. What would it have been like for Moses' wife, you know, with his face? It's like, no, I can't shut it off. Go to sleep. That would have been too bad. But the fact is, glory was reflected from his face. Just a picture of God's magnificence. Wow, that's amazing. So we think of that. And what did God say there? You can't see my face and live. So I have a question for you. Have you seen the face of God? Answer me that question. Have you seen the face of God? Ooh, you guys are thinking because you're not sure what I want. This is not guess what the professor thinks. Just be honest. No. Why not?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Okay. So we see him in specific revelation through his word, general revelation through creation and the things around us. Any other place? Yep. So how he interacts with us. Anything else? Have we seen the face of God in any other way? In Christ. Now, we didn't see that, but people did. What is it? You know, the question's asked, show us the Father. And what was Christ's response? If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. Do you see again? We think of God the Father and we recognize his glory and we see this magnificence of the fact that as he passes before Moses, just one aspect of his character is enough to cause Moses' face to shine, and we think, wow, man, that's a lot of glory. Man, that's amazing. Well, is it not more amazing that God himself clothed himself in flesh and gave us a face? Wow, amazing. Astounding reality. That is why Christmas is so magnificent, because the glory of God is seen. The character of God is seen most perfectly and most fully in the person of Christ. You want to know what God's like? You want to know what his characteristics are? You want to know what he acts like? What he thinks like? How he responds? Look at Christ. The glory of God personified in the flesh as an example to us so that we can see glory. What an amazing thing. That just, it blows me away. So you're in Judges, hopefully, because you should be, because I told you to go there. Judges chapter number 6. And I want to look at a few things here this morning. Another individual who encountered God. I don't know if you've noticed, but what is one of the common threads throughout all of the people that we've looked at so far in terms of their encounter with God? What's one of the things that you've noticed? Anything in particular come out? Especially when it comes to Abraham and Jacob, but Moses as well to some level. It was very much initiated by God. God is the one coming to man. I mean, that is amazing. God is initiating with man. Yes, absolutely. That's a big piece. How did they see God or know that they had found God? Because especially in those two instances with Abraham and Jacob, were they fully aware that they were talking to God? Not initially, right? An angel from the Lord. And then they discover through the process, the angel of the Lord. Who is that? The angel of the Lord, when you see the angel of the Lord, capital A, what is that referencing? Jesus. That's a Christophany, most likely. As far as we can tell, that is a pre-incarnate view of Christ. They are relating with Christ. Christ comes to these guys and he talks with them. That's an amazing reality. Judges chapter 6. So look for that as we read this next section here. Judges chapter 6. Most of you are probably pretty familiar with this section of scripture. This is a very familiar story, but I want to come at it from a different angle. And that's what I've been trying to do with all of these encounters that we've seen. Come at it from a different side and look at what we see. And especially when you get to verse 32, therefore on that day Gideon was called Jerubbabel. That is to say, let Baal contend against him because he broke down his altar. That is the key, in my estimation, the key verse. And I try to, whenever we put these key verses up there, this is that thing that references the turning point, the crux in their experience with God, where they go from something to something different, right? And many times it's a name change. Sometimes it's a character change. And in this case, it would be clearly referenced, especially in the life and times of Gideon, there was something fundamentally different about Gideon as a result of his encounter with God. So keep that in your mind as we read together, and we're going to start there in chapter number 6. And we're going to start with the conditions that he found himself in. The people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord gave them into the hand of Midian 7 years. And the hand of Midian overpowered Israel. And because of Midian, the people of Israel made for themselves the dens that were in the mountains and the caves and the strongholds. For whenever the Israelites planted crops, the Midianites and the Amalekites and the people of the east would come up against them. They would encamp against them and devour the produce of the land as far as Gaza and leave no sustenance in Israel, and no sheep or ox or donkey. For they would come up against their livestock and their tents, and they would come like locusts in number. Both they and their camels could not be counted, so that they laid waste the land as they came in. And Israel was brought very low because of Midian. And the people of Israel cried out for help to the Lord. This is a description of the conditions that they found themselves in. And I want to kind of give you a picture of exactly what's happening. Because sometimes we read this and it's hard for us to envision or imagine exactly how significant this experience was for the children of Israel. But imagine for a moment this story, as we begin this story, you see something incredibly difficult for the nation of Israel. First off, it points out something very important. It says the people of Israel did evil, what was evil in the sight of God. They had no concern or love for the things of God. Is this a common theme for the children of Israel? Oh, yes it is. And remember, we even looked when we were talking through Moses about the fact that Moses was the intercessor between the Israelite nation, as it was a fledgling nation, and God. And when he stood before God, God said, man, if it's not for my grace and my mercy, I would wipe these people out. Because they don't deserve my goodness. They don't deserve. They've not earned the right to be called my people. And yet Moses and God collectively reveal together in their conversation that God, in his graciousness, has chosen that nation. It wasn't something that they did to earn God's favor. And in the same way, the whole point of the book of Judges is you see this cycle again and again and again, where the nation of Israel does evil in the sight of God, and God brings punishment and calamity into their life to draw them back into relationship. And they are restored in fellowship with God, and God blesses. And then, in the midst of blessing, they get cocky. And they feel like, hey, this is good. Life is good. We don't need God anymore. And they begin to divorce themselves of God. And they are again brought low. And they are again punished. And God, in his great faithfulness, comes back and once again says, I love you too much to let you live this kind of life. My intention and plan for you, nation of Israel, is that through you, all the nations would be blessed. I want people to look to you and see through the way that I interact with you that I am a gracious, good, long-suffering God. So that when in the future I provide and open up that blessing to the entire world, there's no question, I am faithful. I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious. I will be merciful to whom I will be merciful. It is not of you, it is because of me. And every time you see that cycle come around, you wonder, God, is this it? Are you done? Are you finally sick of it? These stupid people, what was wrong with them? So think where they found themselves. The nation of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord punished them at the hand of Midian. And so you have this fairly poetic, fairly descriptive story of what would occur. planting season would come along, and the people of Israel would go and they would plow their fields and they would plant their crops. And they would enjoy and reap abundance. Remember, where are they? What land are they in? Promised land. And what is the significance of the promised land in terms of its promise? Why was it called the promised land, besides the fact that God said he'd give it to them? Well, flowing with milk and honey. Very prosperous nation. Very prosperous land. I mean, they'd throw seeds out there and they just grow and they'd have all they need and more. This is a wonderful land that God has given. If you look at how the spies, when they initially went into the promised land, when they saw it, they said, this is an amazing place. It takes two guys to carry the grapes. I mean, this place is prosperous. This place is amazing. And so when you look at that and you consider the fact that that was the land that they were in, suddenly you have this nation of Midian who would sweep into this land. Why do you suppose the Midianites wanted to come into that land? What was the significance of it? What was the draw? I think it's the promise of God. It was blessed. There was an abundance there. So they would plant their crops, and they would water these crops, and they would irrigate them, and they would get them ready for harvest, and they would be right at the point where they could take that benefit, right, of all of this work that they had done. And suddenly, you'd hear, you know, this call. Like, I envision this, you know, ram's horn. And all of a sudden, over the hill came throngs of these camels with these Midianites on them, more than you could count. And they begin to spread. You know, and you see these epic films. Like, we went and saw The Hobbit on, what was it, Thursday, yeah. And they do the CGI where you all of a sudden you see just like one guy pop up, and then there's a second guy, and then all of a sudden, and then, and next thing you know, this whole field is just coming, and they sweep over the land, and they begin to devour everything in their path. They'll take the sheep, the ox, the donkeys. They'll take the wheat. They'll take the corn. They'll take anything that you have. They will kill you if you try to stop them. It is an impossible thing. And I can imagine when this first started to happen, the people of Israel were racking their brains for thinking, trying to think of ways that they could protect themselves. All right, let's do this. And, you know, it also reminds me a little bit of, and you guys aren't going to be surprised by this reference, you guys know Bug's Life? I know Bug's Life very well. I could probably quote you Bug's Life, every last piece of it, because we watch a lot of animation in my house. And it's not only because the kids like it. But the fact is, in Bug's Life, right, what's the whole point? They have the whole plot is built around the idea that the grasshoppers will come and they're going to take their food. And so they have this big leaf that they're stacking up all this corn and this wheat on, right? And they have to get that ready. And if they don't do that well, if they're not efficient in gathering all that food, then there won't be enough for themselves. So I can think in my mind, initially, maybe the Israelites tried, you know, maybe the first thing that they tried to do is set up a garrison. So they, you know, you get these like a fence, you know, barbed wire. Let's put barbed wire up, right? It powerless. They just could and move through. Well, that didn't work. Let's try negotiating with these guys. Look, you guys realize you're getting a huge benefit out of this. You don't work for this. You don't have to do anything besides get on your camel when it's ready. It's like drive-through. You need to at least leave some for us so that we stick around long enough to continue to, you know, can't you let us have some of it? Nothing. They'll take it all. They'll strip the land of everything. They don't even care if the Israelites die. Why not? Because then they get their land back. I mean, there's no reason for them to want Israel there in the first place. They try everything they can think of and nothing works. They continue every time growing season comes. Every time there's even something revealed as being valuable shows up, the Midianites and the Amalekites, they just come and they strip the land like locusts. It's like walking through the Donahoe's front yard. I mean, just everywhere you look, there's these locusts and they're coming through. Not anymore. I know it was better this year. That was good. But the fact is they just devour everything. And if you've ever seen locusts like that, it's crazy. They won't leave anything. So that's the context. How long does it say that this goes on with the children of Israel? 7 years. I have a question. At the end of that paragraph, what do you see? The last verse, I think it's verse 7. And the children of Israel cried out to God. 7 years? What would possess you to wait 7 years to ask for God's help? That's a long time. That is a long time for every single growing season to have everything wiped out. Every single time that you have something of value, getting it taken from you. Having to progressively go and hide. I mean, look what they do when it comes time. It says the reason why there are little sheds and shacks in the woods and holes in the grounds and caves. The reason why, by the way, those were there so much is because of this. Remember when you have the narrative of David as he's running from Saul and he's going and hiding in these caves and different things? A lot of those were established as protection in this era. when you had these people who would come. They were so fearful. They wouldn't even stand and protect their ground. You know, in my mind, I see like the farmer standing there with like a sad look on his face and his pitchfork as they come near him. No, they weren't going to be near there because they'd probably die. They would actually leave there and they would go and hide so that they wouldn't be killed. I mean, this is a terrifying situation. For 7 years, this went on. After 7 years, if every single year you are stripped of everything you have, by the time 7 years end, do you suppose that you're in very good shape? They were brought low, the Lord says. The Bible says they were brought incredibly low. To me, that's the end of yourself. They finally came to the place where they have nothing left. You know, maybe they had a little bit of gold from the good time, and they were able to go and buy some of their food back from the Midianites. Maybe they had a little bit left over where they could hide a few bags or things in some of these caves that they didn't know where they were. But after 7 years, all of your resources are gone and there's nothing left. They are at the end of themselves and they finally cry out to God. What took them so long? So they get to that point where they cry out to the Lord. When the people of Israel cried out to the Lord on the account of the Midianites, the Lord sent a prophet to the people of Israel. And he said to them, "Thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, I led you up from Egypt and brought you out of the house of bondage. And I delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of all who oppressed you, and drove them out before you and gave you their land. And I said to you, I am the Lord your God. You shall not fear the gods of the Amorites and the land in whose land you dwell, but you have not obeyed my voice." How much fun would that be to hear? That's their answer to prayer. What was their answer to prayer? Someone tell me, what was the answer? So they finally, after 7 years, their kids are starving. They are at the end of themselves and they finally are broken and they say, "God, help us." And what is God's response? What does he do? Does he open the windows of heaven and shower them with good gifts? Does he bring them the Amalekites' heads and the Midianites' heads on a platter? What happens? Someone tell me, what did they get for praying? The truth. Isn't that funny? They get the truth for praying. They are praying at this point. Why are they at the end of themselves? Because they've tried everything they can think to do. And the only thing that they can think that's left is, well, let's just pray to God. And God says, you want to know? You want to know the truth? You got to start with the truth. God is gracious. God is merciful. And you'll see how merciful God is as he unfolds his plan for them. But he starts with the truth. And that's one of the things that we're missing in our understanding of the graciousness of God in modern Christianity. We want God to immediately bless. We want God to immediately say, "Oh, you have a problem? Oh, I'm terribly sorry. You only have two cars and you want a boat too? For sure. Oh, I'm terribly, what was I thinking? Here, have a boat. Have two. Have three. And here's some other stuff for you as well." In our mind, we think that's how God does business because it's benefiting us. And the children of Israel, finally, after they're tired of watching their livelihood disappear, they finally pray to God. And God says, "Before I do anything, let me remind you of the truth. I will send you a preacher who will tell you the truth." That will hurt. That was not comfortable. That was not enjoyable for the children of Israel to be reminded of the fact that the God that they are finally crying out to could have helped them at any point. What does he first remind them about himself? "I'm the God that saved you from Egypt. Every single person that you encountered that resisted my plan, I destroyed in front of you. I blessed you. I gave you this land. You have everything that you had because of me. And now you're coming and saying you need help because you're at the end of your own resources?" No one likes hearing that. It reminds me a little bit of myself at some level where, you know, I want to make my own way. And I did this a lot with my dad, where I would try to come up with my own solutions, you know, and you do everything you can think to do. And you're like, "Oh man," I remember specifically, you guys have seen one of my tools in my garage is my dad's radial arm saw. And those radial arm saws, they have the little switch, but then they also have those little yellow keys. You guys know what I'm talking about, right? The little yellow key. If you don't have that yellow key in there, it won't turn on. Well, we didn't have the yellow key for the radial alarm saw. And so I'm racking my brain trying to figure out what I can do to kind of get that thing to latch. So I jury-rigged this whole like little, I think it was like a, what do you call those? Paperclip, a little paperclip thing to put in there to try to like, and it was just, it would sometimes work and sometimes wouldn't. And it shut off in the middle of the pole, you know, which is really dangerous. I'm like, "Oh, this is so annoying." And I'm struggling and I'm trying and I'm trying to think of what can I do? And finally, I'm just like, maybe my dad has it like in a little baggie somewhere. And so I go to my dad. I say, Dad, do you have those little yellow keys? He's like, yeah, I know that one's lost. I just take it off from the other machine and I put it in that one. Oh, I never thought of that. There's another machine over here with the little yellow key right there. And you're like, oh, if I would have just... You know, you're so frustrated when someone tells you there's a solution and it was an easy one. And you've been racking your brain trying to come up with an answer. And all of a sudden, somebody smarter than you comes along and says, I could have solved this. It's not always the most comfortable situation to find yourself in. You're like, why did you have to say that? Why couldn't you have at least been like, wow, that's a really tough one. Let me think. I'll call you back when I come up with a solution, you know. But it's just like, boom, like that. That's kind of what's going on. As the preacher tells them the truth, the nation of Israel, this is your God. This is the one that's brought you here. What is wrong with you? God, he can do this. He can solve the problem. And so that's where the people are left. So at that point, and you know what's interesting? Is after that, and we're not even told who this preacher is, this prophet. We don't know who he is. But he comes and he says his piece and he leaves. Okay, so now what? Great God, I'm so glad that you told me the fact that you could have solved this at any point. Great, I'm glad you told me the fact that this is my own fault that we're here. Wonderful, thank you. Now what? Doesn't change my circumstances. Doesn't change my reality. God, I still need help. Just because you told me the truth doesn't mean I don't need help. And so at that point, the conditions are ripe for God to intervene. And God steps into the situation, into the history, and he begins to change dramatically the situation for the children of Israel. Starting in verse number 11. Now the angel of the Lord came and sat under the terebinth at Ophrah. Not Oprah, but Ophrah. Which belonged to Joash the Abizrite. All right, so the first thing I want to do is I want to point out something. What do you notice there? The angel of the Lord came and sat under the terebinth. All right, this is significant. This is one of those Christophanies. Once again, the angel of the Lord. Now, I know that's not big A there, at least not in my version. But again, anytime you have the singular possessive pronoun, the angel of the Lord, this is very likely God or Christ himself coming. And he sits down under this tree, this oak tree at Ophrah. While the son of Gideon was beating out wheat in the winepress, to hide it from the Midianites. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, the Lord is with you, O mighty man of valor. And Gideon said to him, please, sir, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? And where are all his wonderful deeds that our fathers recounted to us, saying, did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt? But now the Lord has forsaken us and given us into the hands of Midian. This is so fascinating when God initiates contact. And again, what do you recognize here? First off, angel of the Lord, a pre-incarnate view of Christ, comes and he sits under an oak tree. And he sits under this oak tree because he's going to appear to an individual, Gideon. So where is Gideon? And I know you guys have heard this story before, but I think this is hilarious. I find this so funny. What's Gideon? Where is he at? He's in a wine press. What is a wine press? Have you guys ever seen has it ever been described to you what these things look like? Basically a hole in the ground, essentially. You'd have these cisterns that were dug out to contain the juices from the wine as they'd crush the grapes. And so they'd have these kind of down low in the ground, and then they'd usually build it almost into a side of a hill, for instance, so that it would then you'd have a section where you could actually dig a trough or build a trough that then could come out of that press. And so as the juice is squeezed from the wine, that would flow down into your pots, right? So it's in a hidden space. It's usually in the shade. You'll notice where is it that the angel of the Lord appears? The terebinth at Ophrah. This is a shaded area. It's a very specific place. But the angel of the Lord appears there, and Gideon is hanging out in the bottom of this wine press. And he is hiding as he's threshing out wheat. So that's the other thing that I find so fascinating about this character. Gideon is a young man, and he recognizes there's a problem. So he's managed to solve the problem to the best of his abilities, right? There's nothing for anyone. The food is gone. There is no resources for the nation of Israel. So at this point, he's down in this wine press, and he's doing his best to thresh out handful at a time this wheat. That's what I envision. Normally, when you would thresh wheat in this instance, you would go up on a hillside. And the reason you do that is because you get this space on a hillside where the wind would blow, and you would take huge bundles of this wheat and you would thrash that stuff to get the kernels out of their husk. And then you'd throw it up in the air, and the heavy kernels would fall back to the ground, and the chaff or that extra stuff, the husks and things would be blown away. I mean, that was the efficient way of doing it. And usually it was a big operation, you know. You'd have the whole family out on this hillside. And often during that time, you'd have singing, you'd have dancing, you'd have all this stuff going on in celebration of this abundant harvest. That's how it usually works. But in this moment, you envision something entirely different. You see Gideon hiding in a hole in the ground with a little pile of wheat in front of him. There's no wind down there. He has to make his own. So he's maybe crushing that wheat between his hands. Whew, blowing. Doesn't work very well. He'd crush it again. Whew, blow. That's all I've got. One handful. And he put that one handful into a small bag. And he'd come back and one handful at a time, trying to crush out just enough wheat for himself and for his family to have just some bread. The discrepancy between these two visions is astounding. It shows how low God has brought the nation. One man hiding for fear that even a handful of wheat would be enough to bring the Midianites down to steal it from him. And the angel of the Lord, I can almost see it, picture it in my mind. The angel of the Lord is sitting on a rock, watching this process happen. Whew, he blows a little bit more wheat. He's quiet. He watches. Whew, blows again. A little bit more wheat. And finally, the angel says, "What are you doing? Oh, mighty man of valor." That is ironic. That is hilarious. That is the Old Testament version of an ironic statement, a joke, really. But it's currently ironic. It's not going to stay ironic. It's going to become prophetic. But at this moment, God identifies this young guy hiding in the hole in the ground and says, "Hey, you're a man of valor. You mighty man of valor. Where are you? Who are you?" He is describing something to Gideon. And Gideon's response is to be expected. Does Gideon know who he's talking to at this point? Probably not. Just like all the other guys that have encountered this before, he's like, "Well, first off, what would you do if you're trying to hide your action? You know, and all of a sudden somebody, you know, it's this quiet and maybe like a little bit of an echo chamber down in that hole. And all of a sudden you hear somebody say, 'Hello, mighty man of valor, valor, valor.' Woo-hoo!" You know, you just see the wheat fly and his heart beats a million miles an hour as he looks up. He's not supposed to be doing this. This is against the law, against the rules. And finally he realizes that this guy doesn't appear to mean him any harm. And so he responds out of his gut instinct. And what does he say? He says, "What are you talking about? God? Who's this God? This God you talk about that blessed us and that honored us, who is he? The only thing I know of this God is what my parents have told me. They told me how wondrous he is. They told me how magnificent he was as he brought us out of Egypt. Yeah, I've heard of this God. But obviously, where is he? Who is this guy? Because the fact is, our situation at this point, I mean, look where I'm at. I'm standing in the bottom of a wine press trying to get just enough bread for dinner. Who is this God you're talking about?" And so he responds in a way that's to be expected at this moment. And he kind of laughs at what he recommends. And the Lord turned to him and said, "Go in this might of yours and save Israel from the hand of Midian. Do not I send you?" That verse right there is another one of those pinnacle verses. Go in this might of yours. What might is that? Again, that's an ironic statement. Is this a mighty man? Is Gideon mighty at this point? No. He's anything but. He's weak. He's insignificant. And God says, "That is exactly your strength." Does that sound familiar to you? What does that remind you of? When God identifies his weakness, his fear, and his struggle as strength, what does that remind you of? There's a verse in the New Testament. Yeah, what did he say? "When I am weak, then I am strong." You are mighty. You're a man of valor. What? I'm a little guy hiding in a hole in the ground. Exactly. You're weak. And that is might. Go in this might of yours, because I will be with you. That is astounding. God says, "I'm going with you. You're going to be strong. You're going to be magnificent and mighty." So what is his response? He says, "Go, I will be with you." And he said to him, "Please, Lord, how can I save Israel? Please, Lord, please. Oh, please. How could I save Israel?" He looks at himself and he makes an assessment of who he is. And his assessment of himself is not appropriate. It's not my assessment that matters, but it's God. It's not my estimate. It's God's estimate. He says, "Look at who I am. Are you serious? Please, Lord, how can I save Israel? Behold, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house." I mean, he's giving his pedigree. He's like, okay, let's be honest about this for a second. I am a nerd's nerd. I am the worst of the worst. I am of the weakest clan. I got nothing going for me. Are you serious? Look who you're talking to. I think you don't realize who I am. And it's almost like he has to explain to this Lord. And at this point, he's beginning to transition between, okay, well, this appears to be someone from God because they're saying the Lord is with you and he's prophesying something that will happen to me. He says, I really think you've got the wrong guy here. I'm really convinced that this is not all that you think it is. Who does that remind you of? Moses, every other, Abraham. I mean, how often does God do that? God comes to weak. Why? Why does God work through those that are weak? Because then he gets glory because his character is reflected through their weakness. What is the thing they had that was going for them? They obeyed God. They took God at his word. And they were able to then reflect the nature of God through their actions. That is who God wants to use and longs to use. Why does God save those that surrender to him? Why does God rescue them and provide them with the Spirit? Because they have acknowledged their weakness, because we recognize, God, I have nothing good in me. I have nothing worthy of recommendation. God, I am as weak as they come. And God says, and I can save. Because my glory will then be displayed in my coming into you, into my possessing of you. And as you do great things for God, I get glory. That's the heart of the gospel. It's a willingness to embrace my own weakness and to say, I am the least of all. Who says that? Paul himself says that. Every great man of God recognizes his own weakness, embraces it even, and in some ways thinks, God, I don't know if you realize how foolish I am. I don't know if you realize how ridiculous this recommendation is that you're making of me. Because I am the worst of the worst. I'm the last one you should be picking. And God says, that's why I picked you. Because you're weak. It's not my estimate that matters. It's God's. God has a plan. So at that point, God says that he is going to do something with Gideon. The Lord said to him, but, so he says, okay, here's all my reasons why you shouldn't do this. I mean, do you know who I am? Do you know how weak I am? And God says, but I will be with you. I will be with you. Why is this even a problem? And you shall strike the Midianites as one man. And he said to him, if I have now found favor in your eyes, then show me a sign that it is you who speak with me. Please do not depart from here until I come to you and bring out my present and set it before you. And he said, I will stay until you return. I love this because this is, again, an extension of grace. Gideon is freaked out about what God's suggesting. He's like, are you kidding me? Are you really sure? And in his own mind, he's wondering, am I even imagining? Maybe my hunger's finally got to me. Maybe this is all just fake. I got to figure out whether this is really what it says it is. And this reminds me again of Abraham. Same type of thing that Abraham did, right? When he encounters, he says, wait here, I'm going to make you food. I'm going to make you something. At this point, he says, I want to prove whether or not you are who you say you are. Would you mind waiting for a second while I go do something really quick and come back? This is something that sticks with Gideon. Man, we have too many guys. With Gideon throughout his existence. He's always like, okay, but yeah, I really like that, but can I have one other thing just real fast? Could I have the fleece be wet and the ground be dry? I mean, the ground be dry and the fleece be wet. Okay, but could you do this one other thing for me? You know, he's got this weakness about him. And God in his grace and in his mercy says, hey, you are exactly who I need you to be. You're weak-willed. You're fear-filled. And that's exactly what I need. So yeah, if you need to go prove this to yourself, by all means go. And God patiently waits by the tree for Gideon to go make this preparation. So check out what Gideon does. This is funny. I will stand to your tent. So Gideon went to his house and prepared a young goat and unleavened cakes from an ephah of flour. And the meat he put in a basket and the broth he put in a pot and brought them to him under the terebinth and presented them there. So he makes this whole meal. He goes, and what does he know? How does he know to do this? He's probably seen it before. There's some indication, because again, what he's essentially doing is he's making a sacrifice. But he appears to have very little context for that. The nation of Israel has regularly rejected God and his plans. So he goes to this trouble of, putting together this whole food. And I like that he put the broth in a pot. That's nice. He's a good guy. Set up a good meal there and brought them to him under the terebinth and presented them. And the angel of the Lord said to him, take the meat and the unleavened cakes and put them on this rock and pour the broth over them. Really? Because I was kind of thinking that you were going to eat them. But okay, so he's got all this food that he's prepared. And they're on this boulder, really, this big rock that's described. And the angel of the Lord says, okay, thank you for that. I want you to spread out these strips on this rock. I want you to take these bread loaves that you've made. I want you to set them there. And I want you to take the broth and I want you to pour it all over the top of this stuff. Gideon's like, all right, I'm not really sure why, but I'll go ahead and do that. And so he pours it all over. Then the angel of the Lord reached out the tip of the staff that was in his hand and touched the meat and the unleavened cakes. and fire sprang up from the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened cakes. And the angel of the Lord vanished from his sight. Then Gideon perceived that he was the angel from the Lord. And Gideon said, "Alas, O Lord my God, for now I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face." But the Lord said to him, "Peace be to you, do not fear, you shall not die." Then Gideon built an altar there to the Lord and called it, "The Lord is peace, Jehovah Shalom." To this day it stands at Ophrah, which belongs to the Abizurites. This is a really interesting section, because now you see Gideon beginning to understand the significance of this encounter. Up to this point, he's just been going with his gut, you know? He's like, "I don't know, maybe I'll do this." And he makes all this stuff, and he sets it on the rock, and he's not sure what's going to happen. And suddenly the Lord demonstrates who he is. Conclusively, he sets his staff on the rock, and the rock produces fire, and it consumes the meat and the bread. And what was Gideon's response? What would you predict Gideon's response to be? Scream like a girl. I mean, the fact is he freaks out. He's like, oh no. I mean, just what you expected. He said, "I want you to prove that who you are who you say you are." That was the whole point of this, right? Wasn't the whole point of this to prove that God was who he says he was? And God proves that he is who he says he is. And he freaks out. Oh, it's for real. I was hoping it was a dream. And all of a sudden, he's left with it. The angel of the Lord vanishes from his sight. And what's his first thought? I'm going to die. I saw God face to face. I'm going to die. He's terrified because it does. And the terror that comes into his heart is multifaceted, really, if you think about it. Because in addition to the fact that he just saw God, he now also, it's confirmed that what God said he was going to do, he's going to do. He said, "You're a mighty man of valor. You're going to defeat the Midianites." Well, I was hoping that wasn't so. I really don't know if I want that job. But now, in addition to the fact that I know you're God, I also know now that what you said is true. And it freaked him out. He's convinced he's going to die. And the angel of the Lord, I almost hear this in my mind, because remember, it says it vanished from his sight. And then the angel has to come back and say, "Okay, relax." You know, you hear the voice. It's like, "It's a fine. You're not going to die. Relax. It was me. I'm part of this process." I really love his response, because his response to me indicates that his spirit of fear hasn't left him. And that's the thing in our minds. We think when we encounter God, everything's going to be different. And we're right, it will. I mean, nothing was the same for Gideon from this point forward. But his essential character, the character that God recognized in him, he's still Gideon. He's still terrified. But God is using him. And in his terror, he is going with God. And that, I think, is something that we have to recognize. We often are told, if you see God, or if you are engaged in the process of ministry, or if you do these things, man, you're going to be a fighter for God. You know what? If you're a scared person naturally, recognize that that's part of who you are. And God isn't sitting there saying, "I can't believe this. This is so disappointing. I was really hoping you'd be a lot more bold." The fact is, God says, "I use you in your weakness. I recognize you are who you are. And I am changing you to reflect my character, my glory. But it's going to be in a way that other people will look at and say, this is totally not you. There's no question this is not who I know you to be." And your answer is going to be very obvious. "I know, right?" Sounds like Michaela. I know. This is God. That's the beauty of it, is that God gets the glory from this encounter. And at this point, God is magnified. The consequences. Let's finish up with the consequences quickly. This is what occurs as a result of this. "And that night the Lord said to him, 'Take your father's bull and a second bull, 7 years old, and pull down the altar of Baal that your father has, and cut down Asherah that is beside it, and build an altar to the Lord your God on the top of the stronghold here, and with stones laid in due order. Then take the second bull and offer it as a burnt offering with the wood of the Asherah that you shall cut down.' So Gideon took 10 men of his servants and did as the Lord had told him. But because he was too afraid of his family and the men of the town to do it by day, he did it by night." Oh, I love it, because again, it reveals the reality of Gideon at this point. God comes to him and says, "Remember when I told you that you were going to be a mighty man of valor? First job, job number one, I want you to go and I want you to take your dad's bull." So obviously at this point, there's still some interesting relationship between him and his father. "Okay, my dad's bull, I might have to ask permission, but I should be okay. And a second bull at 7 years old." What, 7 years, by the way? What's the significance of a 7-year-old bull? How long have they been? So how long have they been protecting this bull from getting stolen? 7 years. This bull has managed to avoid getting caught for 7 years. So this is a pretty special thing. I mean, they have this pretty well hidden. So he's supposed to take this thing that they've been trying not to kill for 7 years, not to lose for 7 years. He's supposed to take that of his dad's as well. Okay, all right, I'm starting to get a little bit more nervous at this point. So I've got these two things I'm supposed to do, and I want you to go to your father's, you know, your father's worship house. And I want you to use his own bowl, and I want you to bulldoze it. Get it? Bulldoze it. I want you to tear it down. I want you to destroy that. And I want you to cut down the Asherah, this grove of trees that was dedicated to this other idol. And I want you to burn that. All the stones that you get, the rubble from that, I want you to build an altar. I want you to burn the trees, and I want you to sacrifice these animals. That's a pretty big response. That's a pretty big requirement of God, is it not? I mean, be honest. What is Gideon? What is expected of Gideon at this point? He is turning against his family. He is doing things that will be terrifying. And he's supposed to do this, and it's not even something he can do on his own, so he has to convince or pay 10 other guys to help him out, and he's terrified. So because of his father and because of the men of the city, he does it at night. Did God say he couldn't do it at night? No, he didn't. Did he obey God? He absolutely did. But he still revealed his character in the process. God wasn't mad at him for doing it at night. God's fine with that. It's kind of funny because at this point, you recognize that God is working within the context of what Gideon knew. The first thing we see that God's proof that he needed, and we saw this already, was gracious. God was graciously proving himself. But the command that God gave him at this point was so vital. And if we had time, which we don't, unfortunately, but we could go back to Judges 8:22-28. That's the end of the story of Gideon. And there you see something terrible has happened. After all of this has occurred, after Gideon has rescued the nation of Israel, and he has responded by saying, they wanted to make him king, him and his grandson and his son and his grandson. You'll be our rulers, man. We love you, Gideon. You're the best. And Gideon says, no, God is your ruler, which is a great response. But then Gideon says, hey, by the way, would you mind, since they're all Ishmaelites, would you mind giving me your earrings? Sounds familiar. Reminds us of Aaron. Give me your earrings. And he makes an ephod. What's an ephod? Do you guys remember what an ephod is? It's the breastplate, right? And who wore it? The priest wore it. And what was it for? It had pockets in it that would carry the Urim and Thurim. It was really a way to represent my relationship with God. He makes this ephod out of all of these earrings, and he puts it in his own town. And in his mind, I can see him saying, you know what? This is great. This is a really good thing. If I'm supposed to judge the people, I want to be judging with God. And so I'm going to make the thing that God told us to make. So he makes this ephod and he puts it in his own town. And what does it become? We have to read it. We just have to. We got time. We'll be okay. Turn over to chapter 8, verses 22-24. This just shows how significant God's demand of Gideon at this point is. 22-24. Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, you and your son and your grandson, for you have saved us from the hand of Midian. And Gideon said to them, I will not rule over you. My son will not rule over you, and the Lord will rule over you. And Gideon said to them, let me make a request of you. Every one of you give me the earrings from his spoil. For they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. And they answered, we will willingly give them. And he spread a cloak, and every man threw the earrings to his spoil. And the weight of the gold earrings, as he requested, was 1,700 shekels, about 34 pounds, or 43, I think. 43 pounds, I'm dyslexic, so one of the two. Pounds of gold, I mean a lot of gold, besides the crescent ornaments and the pennants and the purple garments worn by the kings of Midian, besides the collars that were around the necks of their camels. Gideon made an ephod out of it and put it in his city in Ophrah. And all Israel whored after it there, and it became a snare to Gideon and to his family. What happens to this ephod? It becomes an idol. It becomes a snare to Gideon and his family. Isn't that a sad, in some ways I wish that wasn't the end of the story. But again, recognize what God was telling Gideon to do with his father's grove, to destroy the idolatry that is represented there. Here again, even Gideon is not immune to the snare of turning a physical thing into a representation of God. Right? That's really what this was. It's another golden calf. They were worshiping God. Gideon knew who God was. He had relationship with God, and yet somehow he still manages to attach his affection to the physical thing. Do we do that? All the time. This is one of the biggest snares that we face in American churches. We idolize our building. We idolize our programs. We idolize our understanding of doctrine. I mean, we even turn our distinctions into idols as a representation of God. Well, if you believe what I believe as a Baptist, well, then you clearly are in a better spot. And you know what happens? If you take that theology and take it in its natural progression, there's a group out there called Baptist Brides. And these Baptist Brides are under the impression that they are a direct line from Peter. They represent the bride of Christ. Everyone else, sure, you're going to heaven, but we're flying first class. We're the Baptist brides, man. The fact is, they take that natural thinking and they turn their theology, their orthodoxy, into an idol. And they whore after it. And they love it more than they love God. Listen, if your distinction as a Christian, if your denominational affiliation is more important to you than a relationship, an unhindered relationship with God, you are idolizing, you are whoring after something that may be a good thing, but it's not God. And that's what happens at this point. God commands him to break down his father's stronghold and to do this in order to provide them with an understanding of the significance of what he was asking of them. And we finish up here. Then the men of the town rose early in the morning. Behold, the altar of Baal was broken down, and Asheroth beside it was cut down. And the second bull was offered. The second bull. They point out, this is that 7-year bull, man. This is the one that they managed to hold on to. It was sacrificed on the altar that had been built. And they said to each other, "What? What in the world? Who's done this thing?" And after they had searched and inquired, they said, "Gideon, the son of Joash, has done this thing." So they go out. I mean, they go on a witch hunt. They're saying, "Who did this?" They are furious that this has happened. And it finally comes out that Gideon did it. Oh, Gideon, you're so much trouble. Then the men of the town said to Joash, "Bring your son that he may die, for he has broken down the altar of Baal and cut down the Asheroth beside it." But Joash said to all who stood against him, "Will you contend against Baal? Will you contend for Baal, or will you save him? Whoever contends for him shall be put to death by morning. For if he is a god, let him contend for himself, because his altar is the one that got broke down." Therefore, on that day, Gideon was called Jerubbaal. That is to say, let Baal contend against him, because he broke down their altar. Oh, I love this. This is the last thing we're going to look at here. But this is again, one of the reasons why I consider this to be a pinnacle of the story. The men of town freak out when they realize that their good luck is gone. They had good luck, didn't they? 7 years of the Midianites coming through like locusts. Man, they had great luck. That's really helping you a lot, fellas. But they still loved this altar and this grove of trees and all this. And so when it's tore down, when it's destroyed, they think, "Oh, we're going to get the guy." And they find out that it's Joash. And they come to Joash. By the way, whose high place was this? It was Joash's. So they come, they're like, "Good, I'm glad it was Joash's boy. He's the kind of guy that'll really, man, he's going to kill that kid. We're going to go tell him." And they come and say, "Hey, Joash, just so you know, we figured out who ruined your temple. It was your son. Let's kill him." And Joash's response is an interesting one. And I don't really know where it comes from. I don't know if he had this closet in his heart that still belonged to God. I don't know exactly what it was, but he responded, "You know what? What are we saying? If Baal is as strong as he says he is, and it's his temple. It's not even really mine. It was his. Let him do the fighting. I don't really want to kill him. I mean, he's my son, so let's see what Baal does to him." So they changed him. They nicknamed him. I love it. Gave Gideon a nickname. They said, "We'll call him Jerubbaal. Let Baal contend against him." I mean, we're going to name him so that Baal will know exactly who he's supposed to be targeting. So everyone knows where the guy is that Baal's, you know, the curse of Baal is upon him whenever he walks in. Have you ever seen that edition of that or that episode of Mayberry where what's his face? Who's the dumb deputy? Barney Fife, he's so incredibly superstitious that whenever this one guy who has bad juju or whatever on him, whenever he walks into the room, Barney's like walking out of the room like, "Ooh!" You know, he's freaked out because this guy has this curse on him or something like that. I envision that with this for the rest of their existence. You know, Gideon is like, "Oh, he's Jerubbaal." But days pass, nothing happens. He is God's man. And so at that point, you see again and you recognize that God had done something significant through the person of Gideon. One of the things that we recognize here is obedience is essential. He obeyed God. When God said do it, he did it. Heroism is optional. Remember, this is the truth. And sometimes we get the impression in modern society, I hear a lot of people calling out for men of valor, brave-hearted men who will go after God with all of their guts. And I love that. I really do. But remember, obedience is essential. Heroism, it's optional. God doesn't necessarily require heroism of you. And if he does, he does it in a way that will get him glory anyway. Sometimes we feel like, especially as men, we sort of have to work ourselves up to this, you know. Obedience, that's all that was required of Gideon. Hey, if you want to do it at night, secretly, and then go freak out in one of the caves, you're more than welcome, but obey God. That is what God expects. And then the final thing that we see in verse number 34, and this is to close out here. Now all the Midianites and the Amalekites and the people of the east came together, and they crossed the Jordan and encamped in the valley of Jezreel. But the Spirit of the Lord clothed Gideon, and he sounded the trumpet, and the Abizarites were called out to follow him. And he sent messengers throughout all of Manasseh, and they too were called out to follow him. And he sent messengers to Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, and they went up to meet them. That statement, Spirit of God clothed Gideon, it's more like God clothed himself in Gideon. I adore that. Because that represents the heart of what we're talking about when we talk about an encounter with God. God takes you and he moves through you. It's like you're a robe that he's wearing as he does his business. And when Gideon, in boldness, sounds the trumpet of war, it's not Gideon's own guts that's making him do that. It's not his own military proudness that's calling him to that. It's God himself working through Gideon's weakness, which is strength. That's the beauty of the gospel. That's the heart of what we talk about when we tell people you have to surrender yourself to the working of God. You have to become willing to allow him to save you. That is the heart of the gospel from start to finish. And that is what made Gideon effective. And God continued through the whole narrative to prove that was the case. It had nothing to do with numbers of men. It had nothing to do with your leadership prowess. It had nothing to do with even your own desires. One of the things about Gideon is that you could look at his motives, because later you find out that when he actually kills the two kings of these marauding armies, they're done over there. I'm very distractible. It's my ADD. Don't worry about it. Those two kings that he kills, they have actually killed his brothers. So there's a blood feud even within Gideon, but that's not even what motivated him. It was the fact that God chose to work through him. Let's look at a few principles just quickly. A couple lessons. 1 Corinthians 1, 26 and 27. For consider your calling, brothers. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful, but not many of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. That is the gospel. Do not present yourself as somehow better and that's why you're saved. You are doing a disservice to the gospel. You're weak. You're foolish. You are a tool that God is using, clothing himself with you. That is all you are. And if you make yourself more, you distract people from the true gospel. Secondly, Gideon knew that a blood sacrifice was necessary when approaching God. Faithfulness was evident in his response. He knew what was required in order to approach God instinctively. He makes that sacrifice, blood. That was a difficult thing because, again, remember, they're not. He didn't have a bunch of stuff sitting on the shelf. When he brings that sacrifice before God to prove who he was, that was out of a difficult, you know, that, an ephah of flour, by the way. That's a funny thing. I didn't even mention this, but he makes these unleavened cakes out of an ephah of flour. That's a lot of flour. And if you figure that you have to make that flour one hand at a time, that's a big deal. He is demonstrating a full-on commitment to determining whether God is who he says he was. And God knew that a blood sacrifice was necessary. Gideon built a permanent altar at the spot, calling it Jehovah Shalom, which means the peace of the Lord. Gideon remembered making peace with God at that spot when he encountered God. Peace was made with God. And that's why he called it peace with God. Because remember, what happens after he's terrified when he sees the face of God? God comes back and says, peace be with you. You're not going to die. I'm with you. And he names that permanent spot. It's still there today, they say, in the passages. To this day, it's still there. That whole idea is that peace was established with God. And that is what made Gideon who he was. And then finally, God clothed himself in Gideon. So to finish off, the encounter that we see here with Gideon and between Gideon and God is very, very important for our own understanding. We need to recognize the significance of this interaction. We like to go to the story of Gideon when he's, you know, got the pitchers and the trumpets and all that stuff. But recognize all that stuff about Gideon's valor and his bravery stems from that last piece. God clothed himself in Gideon. What will make you effective as a Christian? What will make you strong as a believer? What will make you full of valor to accomplish great things for God? A willingness to obey, obedience, faithfulness to God's expectations, and a willingness to be used by God. That is what the encounter with God revealed in Gideon. And as a result of that encounter, Gideon, in spite of himself, became strong. Let's pray. God, thank you so much, Lord, for the privilege that we have of being used by you. Lord, as we consider our own encounter with you, I pray that you will remove from our hearts, Lord, the tendency that we have to lean on our own understanding, on our arm of flesh. Lord, we're so quick to try to come up with our own solutions. Lord, I'm amazed that it took 7 years for the Israelites to finally get sick of the Midianites coming into their camp. But Lord, I have to be honest and look at my own life and see how many areas I continue to fail over and over again. And Lord, I wonder what is wrong. I am so willing to let the marauders take over areas of my life, Lord, without even thinking of asking for your help. Lord, I pray that you'll convict us of our need to be fully dependent on you so that you can transform our action for your glory to reflect your character, your nature. Lord, I praise you for this story. I thank you so much that weak men get used by you. Thank you for the encouragement that is to us, Lord, who are so weak. Lord, I pray that you'll help us to see your hand at work in our lives. Lord, I pray that you'll be with our church here, Lord, that we will reflect that we're not strong or slick or good at getting people here, but Lord, that we are following you wholeheartedly with eyes longing to see your glory, your character reflected through our actions. Be glorified in us, Lord. In your name we pray. Amen. Well, I appreciate